You're listening to Filling Seats, the State of Enrollment Marketing in Higher Ed, hosted by StudentBridge. In this podcast, you'll learn what's working to grow, shape, and sustain enrollment at colleges and universities directly from fellow enrollment marketers, thought leaders, and ed tech innovators. Listen in for proven strategies to fill seats this cycle and beyond. Welcome to episode 12 of Filling Seats. In this episode, you'll hear from Hillary Kane, who is the Chief Communications and Marketing Officer at a private law school in California. You'll hear her talk about the most effective channels for different types of programs and audiences, what prospective law students are looking for during their search, and what the future might look like for virtual or hybrid law programs. Let's meet Hillary.
So my background started out in theater, which is not that uncommon in law students, I've found. I went to law school, graduated in 93, which was another recession. Every time I go to graduate school and graduate, there's a job crisis. I became a civil litigator, and then I fell into a general counsel position and did international licensing and trademark for about 16 years for Body Glove International. It was a great experience, great job. And then I actually transitioned back as kind of a special assistant to the dean, not the current dean. And then this position opened up and I was asked to apply. And the rest is kind of history. I've been there since 2018.
What was it like transitioning from the private sector to higher ed?
Definitely different. Higher ed has some very unique characteristics, as did the action sports world. I went from being around bikini models to law professors from the finest Ivy League schools. So it was definitely an adjustment, but it was a really welcome change for me at the time. You have to find the right job at the right time, and just the pieces all fell into place.
Tell me a little bit about your current role, what you do, and your institution.
I think it's very unique, and it is in the sense that it's a standalone law school. So what that means is we're not connected to a big university. We don't have big university shared resources. We're just all on our own, and we're very small. Our staff is about 100. That's, I think, faculty and staff, maybe 250. And our student body now is a healthy 950. So we're teeny, 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 tiny. And so my current role, I started out in a department that was called public affairs. No one really understands why, but before that, it was public information. When I came on board, I lobbied to have it called MarCom, Marketing and Communications. And the dean at the time was like, oh, marketing, that might be a bad word, which a lot of people think. So the compromise was to put communications in front of marketing, and CoMark was born. So I have an amazing team of really talented people, mostly creatives. I'm a both side of the brain, which I think helps for this role. But I have an amazing cross-trained team, and we handle everything printed, digital, aspirational, every communication, all the websites, all the admissions emails, all of that for the school. It's a constant undertaking with lots of tasks. It's really exciting.
So you're overseeing communications and marketing for the entire institution. So prospective students, current students, alumni, donors, all kinds of stakeholders, everyone.
Pretty much we do share in the responsibility depending on how the institutional advancement team is staffed, determines how much work we do with them, but we collaborate and we are the main voice of the school. So as you can imagine, just very interdepartmental and constantly 25 balls in the air and pulling together a lot of information. I always say like our job is to package the content. We don't really create the content with a few exceptions. But we're always gathering content, which means waiting for content. And then we package it up and make sure that it's on brand, that it's concise and clear and grammatically perfect, and that it represents the school.
What's your relationship like with the admissions office or admissions team?
I think we have a great relationships with our admissions team. Things move so fast and they have an amazingly robust admissions cycle. We pretty much have a 12-month cycle. So it's just constant. And we also segment. So for every email that we work with them on, there are at least two versions of it, sometimes three, depending on which group of applicants. And now we actually have admitted students. We still have prospects. And they also have a great team. And I think it's better than the school has ever coordinated between marketing and sales, basically between admissions and marketing. It's just now where they're changing platforms and it's just a little complicated. And I think one of the things I would love to see is just more continuity, because it's more of a handoff. It's more like we go, we get the leads, we generate a form and we capture that information and then we hand it off. We don't really know necessarily what happens, and it's not tracked on a clear continuum, which I would love to see.
What channels are most effective? What does your office oversee in terms of prospective student recruitment? What does the admissions office oversee? And I'm curious if there's a firm line in the sand or if there is some overlap.
There's a handoff and a firm line as far as collecting data. But as far as from a practical standpoint, it is a smooth continuum. So we work with admissions very closely. We have a list of all their events, which are many. Sometimes in a week, they'll be doing two or three virtual events. And now they're back to doing some on-campus events, which was very exciting. First time in over 2 years. So the collaboration is a very good, steady continuum. And it has worked out very well. We have done well, even throughout the pandemic. We have, don't know how, thank you, universe, we've managed to increase our student body steadily. And I think, again, we're going to deliver another. And it's not just the number, it's the quality and the diversity. And we have so many things that we want to maintain. We're an opportunity school. We look at the whole applicant. We look for things that might indicate success that aren't shown in an LSAT score or an undergrad GPA. A lot of our students worked three jobs while they were in undergraduate school. They're not going to be able to maintain a 4.0, but we look for things that show they were capable of achieving that kind of academic success. So I think that has been a good relationship, and we work very closely with them. We have people designated on my team and their team that work together on certain types of communication. We've recently added a layer of checking of accessibility. Our dean is very committed to it. Now everything gets checked for all the things we always check. And then it's very important to us that it is as accessible as possible. Yeah. And we've had great buy-in from all the departments, particularly admissions, who for years has been saying, are we reaching neurodiverse students? Are we reaching students? Do they know that our campus is ADA accessible? So we're really trying to include that in our messaging and make sure that we toe the line on what inclusion really means. And it's not just racial diversity. It's all kinds of diversity, including ability diversity or neurodiversity.
If you had to say these are the top three channels that are the most effective for us, what would those be?
So as a law school, the LSAC is the foundation where everything starts. Like, even in order to apply to law school, students have to register with the LSAC. And through the LSAC, they opt in to receive marketing from schools. I believe they opt in general. So you can imagine there are about 200 law schools, so they're getting bombarded. So that is what we do with that, is we take that list, and Facebook actually has a process, an algorithm, and it will go and find on Facebook all the people that match. So it matches emails. So that's been really effective for us. So some people will get the general email that we send out to the different levels or where you are in the admissions process, but also they're going to see our social media marketing and social media. Even paid advertising, the bang for the buck for us has been amazing. Our virtual events have been very well attended. Our physical event that we had was maximum capacity. We are trying to do HyFlex and still stream it. We're still trying to get more students from out of town. Being in Los Angeles, we are one of five ABA law schools, I believe, in the area. So it's very saturated and very competitive. The ABA is the American Bar Association, and that along with the AALS, which is the American Association of Law Schools, those are the governing bodies for all of the ABA schools. But the social media marketing has been great. LinkedIn has a high quality and a very good match for our LLM program, our media, our entertainment and media, and also our scale program, which is an accelerated 2-year program, which oftentimes aligns with someone's professional aspirations. Like they're going to take 23 months off work, get that law degree and go back and enhance their agency or enhance their CPA practice or add another dimension to whatever it is they're doing. So it's been a very good lead generator.
We'll be right back.
Want to know exactly how peer institutions are increasing enrollment? Check out 3 case studies in the show notes featuring 3 schools who've grown enrollment consistently over the past several years, including a private liberal arts college in Illinois, a small public school in Nebraska, and a large public institution in Georgia. Or visit studentbridge.com/resources to see how other institutions achieve more, like increasing campus tour numbers, engagement, yield, and beyond. What are some channels that are not as effective as they once were, or maybe you feel, I think we're going to give this one less of a priority?
Everyone wants to like get down on print. So print, but also for law students, the Cypress Media publications, where it's pre-law, national jurist and international jurist, they have adapted very well. So if it was just the magazine that we'd be relying on for people to pick up a magazine, which they still distribute, all of their assets are online, their whole publication, which makes it easier for us to show it off, screenshot it. And it also has newsletters that are, that kind of relate to the different issues. So they're getting more mileage and they're just like very good at promoting the issue. And we rank very highly in their best of lists. And I like those lists as opposed to US News and World Report, which could be very subjective. These are more objective. They measure the amount of programs, the quality of the programs, the amount of students that are enrolled in the programs. So we really value that they have transferred to their kind of high flex. They do digital and they still print. So we haven't stopped doing anything. We are also lucky enough to be able to do some really impressive tribute advertising in Billboard and The Hollywood Reporter, because we have so many alum practicing in music and entertainment. It's just really, we have such a diverse reach and we have to reach all these different subpopulations where they are. So we are spread out across a lot of channels and we haven't found any that are dudding out for us so far. We would stop immediately if there was not ROI. Some stuff, it's hard to count. It's a little less intangible, like when we do our LAX advertising or a big billboard somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's less direct. But I do think that our school is gaining more national notoriety, which is important for us. And some of those bigger stages, we have to be there. People are going to notice that we're not there, even though they're not. It's just like a trade show. You just have to be in the mix.
Is there anything that you feel like your team struggles with in terms of marketing or that you wish that y'all could do better?
I think my team is awesome. Our struggles are mostly internal. It's just the pace and the notification time that we get. Like we get the dean's office, like we need this tomorrow. And it's very hard for us to turn stuff around. We can when we need to. And we know that it's usually just an opportunity that comes up at the last minute. But it's just internal. It's emergency marketing, I call it, which shouldn't really ever exist. I was assuring somebody like, this isn't an emergency commencement. We know it's coming. We've been planning the website. It's just not published yet. Like it's the same time every year. We got it.
Thinking about all law schools and law school recruitment, what are some things that you think other schools do a great job with?
I think they do a great job with, it's really that media, like the third party media, the independent media exposure, like their professors are the go-to people for certain areas of law. And we do have a couple of those, but particularly a look at Loyola and Lori Levinson, and just they have, and Chermarinsky, who was, oh, I think he's at Berkeley, but he started Irvine. He was the first dean. So it's those kind of placements that really are like, wow. So love to see us do more of that. But a lot of those, they have iconic personalities and iconic lawyers. So that, I think, really helps too with the national exposure.
The flip side with other schools, what do you think are some things that they could be doing better?
I don't want to tell them what to do. That would just not be smart for me. But I think one thing I've noticed is the stuff that they're putting out is really busy and the messages get so lost. So I think it's, and we're trying not to do this because we do that kind of kitchen sink messaging. You're trying to be all things to all people at one time. And it's just, it's craziness. It's just, it gets lost. So we are really a fan of segmentation. And I think even though it takes longer, takes more forethought, takes more planning, same thing. I think that segmentation and having the right message for the right subpopulation or subcommunity is really the way to go. Because otherwise your eyes roll back in your head. There's so much information on a single web page or a single handout, a single event even sometimes. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to, even our catalog this year has a theme that weaves throughout. The whole thing is about social justice, even as it applies to entertainment practice, even as it applies to the clinics or even family law or the experiential. We're just weaving that common thread through it. So I just think there's just more good marketing 101 applied to higher education.
In doing this podcast, something that I found is that a lot of people who worked in the private sector and then they come into higher ed, they view what they are marketing as a consumer product and they listen to the quote unquote customer and use that to develop messaging and segmentation. And so you're kind of talking that language. So I'm curious, what are some of the ways that you feel that your prior experience influenced you in what you do now?
My prior experience was really as a transactional fashion law attorney. Once I was there, I went through the executive program at UCLA, but I did not do like straight pure marketing. But I think good marketing is good marketing. We are very storytelling reliant, as all good marketing is. If you think back to the commercials that you remember as a kid, it's always the one that tells a story. And I know, they can make you cry in 30 seconds. Like, that's a really good story. And because we have been around, this is our 110th year, we have so many great stories to tap into. And then we look at every student as the beginning of a new, amazing story. So I think that just understanding just the uniqueness, and it's just the same thing. How do you differentiate yourself? It's just the same marketing 101 principles. And I do think it's ironic that you mentioned a consumer product, because every time they're trying to sell you something, they being the people that bombard you or the email, the Facebook algorithm or whatever, and they're saying, buy this product to sell your product. We're selling a $160,000 product. So on one hand, it's great because we can have a high acquisition cost, but the lower our acquisition costs, the better off. We're very tuition dependent. We don't want our new students' incoming tuition to pay for our marketing. But I always get a little chuckle about that, as if I'm selling a lip gloss or something. And I'd like to sell $160,000 product with a really high ROI. Sometimes a $9 Facebook ad will get 10 applicants. It's crazy. That's not the complete acquisition cost. A lot of other things go into it, a lot of moving parts. And we also track which events they come to. But it was so scary and interesting to find out that during the pandemic, our admissions didn't really suffer. It was hard. We had to pivot. Everything was done differently. I think schools that think they can continue to do that, I fantasize about that. But then everyone else would have to do it, because then you're competing with people that are seeing the people and touching the people and going to the fairs and doing all that. So I don't think it'll ever stay purely virtual, but I think that virtual elements of it will remain. And sometimes it's easier to get someone to log in to a Zoom than to get them to drive across three counties and come to your school.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. What changes do you see happening in the future for law school recruitment, law school enrollment marketing?
Well, a lot of that's going to depend on the law school programming and how that changes, because everyone right now was in this kind of catch up with technology. So now most schools, even that never thought, we have professors that said, I'm not teaching online. Guess what? Everyone taught online. I'm not teaching on Zoom. Yes, you are. And by and large, everyone got on board, and it was an amazing like 3-day transformation from in-person to online. So I think that there will be more hybrid programs, more high flex programs, things like that. And I think now it's a technology race, because everyone did it. Everyone did it fine. But now it's going to be who can do it
the best
and the most effectively and probably the most beautifully, because now we're starting to add animations. And now most of the professors can edit their own videos and caption their own videos and things that we never would have asked professors to do. And they get asked to do an awful lot. They're probably maxed out right now, but now we're asking them to learn accessibility and how to create accessible syllabi, right, and course materials. So it's a big burden on the profs. Props to the profs. And also the staff too. The things that we started doing in the pandemic, we're still doing, and now we're adding the live stuff back into it. And everyone I've talked to is like, I forgot how to do stuff in real life. Our admissions deems, like, I forgot, like, we check people in and then you walk them places. And it's like, no, we forgot how to do that. So it will be interesting to see the medium or the balance that settled. I have no idea. A lot of it for us is going to depend on what the other schools around us are doing, because it's a really competitive market. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm as interested as you are. I have no idea.
Do y'all offer fully online, or you're mainly an in-person school?
Our evening program is 50-50. It is a hybrid format, but the ABA doesn't allow us to have a fully online format. Believe it or not, all throughout the pandemic, schools had to apply for special variances. Even though everyone needed it, you weren't allowed to be open. So I don't know what's going to happen. The ABA is going to loosen the restrictions more with the success of the St. Mary's 100% online course or program is going to be. We now, I think, have numbers from the first hybrid program, which was a school that had merged, and they still tend to be smaller programs, mm-hmm, like 35 students.
Do you think the reason for the such strict rules on not having online law programs, mm-hmm, do you think that is meant to be exclusionary? Do you think that it's to protect the quality?
One thing you hear in higher ed a lot is, well, that's how we've always done it. And law schools have historically been the last to do that. Like medical schools were having virtual rounds before law schools were having a hybrid evening class on torts. We're not always the first to jump on these new things. And the pedagogy is very established. The Socratic method, and you know, we've always done it this way, even though you're students might not react the best or learn the best in that environment. So I think part of it was just the traditional law school experience was that large 1L class and the Socratic method and standing when you speak and being terrified and attrition and all these things that you think of, to just really having to adapt to overcoming the stereotype that online education is like second rate, it's not high quality, which I think, especially from the bar pass rates from that summer 2020 bar, we had our highest bar pass rate we'd had in a very long time. We're a proud 84.7%, which is very high, especially in California, and very high for us. People proved the idea wrong. Even the LSAT courses, I believe, now are still being delivered virtually, as is the LSAT. So the pandemic forced higher ed and law schools in particular to really reevaluate the quality of a high flex, a hybrid, or an online education. So it's just going to be, again, interesting to see the balance that the schools strike. And the balance of school strike is going to be dictated by how the students want to learn, probably.
And as Gen Z ages into being the law student population.
Yeah, so we have some already. We're getting ready for Gen Z, and I think it's going to be a great ride. It's going to be interesting, but we are committed to delivering the education in the way that's going to benefit not just our students, but also the profession. And we have groundbreaking summer courses that are all LGBTQ sexual orientation focused, and the legal issues that affect that community are vast and can be very scary to navigate. So we're educating a whole new generation of lawyers so they can help clients in those communities, like, better address the legal issues. Like, you think of even changing your name or trying to change your gender or get housing or all of these things that affect that population. I think we're just going to see schools like trying to outdo each other in technology and progressive education and in trying out new things, which is now encouraged instead of discouraged. So to me, it's very exciting and it's great.
What is an app or a marketing tool that you could not live without?
HubSpot. We get a lot of data from them. And I'm a little worried about our post-cookie world, but the Google Analytics is a really great tool and talks with all of our other apps that we use. And other than that, right now, because we're so focused on accessibility, we have a big agreement with Site Improve, and we actually hired a company to remediate things on the website and train us so going forward we don't create inaccessible content. So those are kind of our go-tos and our core. But it all boils down to people. At the end of the day, it's the people that are inspiring the content, creating the content, and everything else is really just a package for it.
If you could go back 5 to 10 years and give yourself advice, what would it be?
I know this is going to sound really weird. A couple really smart people have said this to me. They said, care less. And the reason they said that is, first of all, you should never be in love with anything that you make or that you do, because it makes you take things personally. Don't take things to heart as much. And that's advice for me, but I think that's good advice in general in professions, because you become your job and your job becomes you, and it's not healthy. Also, I would have started improv 5 years sooner, because I started improv in 2018. I'm really into it. So that's it. I would say care less. Follow the four agreements, all those, and just develop life balance and have a great hobby that you love.
Awesome. Thank you so much for interviewing with us today, and it was great having you.
It was great to be here. Thanks so much.
This is the Filling Seats podcast, hosted by StudentBridge, where we help enrollment teams achieve more by fusing authentic storytelling with industry-leading technology and personalized digital experiences. If you're looking to attract more, amaze more, and achieve more, visit studentbridge.com. To connect with this episode's guest, check out the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. For more information about the podcast or to let us know you'd like to be a guest, visit studentbridge.com/podcast. Thanks for listening.